strikes on the Iraqi-Syria border were aimed at deterring militia and Iran from further attacks on its forces or facilities is not based on realities. The Russian military says terrorists are planning a false flag chemical attack in Syria's Idlib province. And top UN officials warn the Security Council that more than 400,000 people in Ethiopia's Tigray are now in famine and that there is more risks of clashes in the region. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the rainy capital, Tehran. It's great to have you with us. Now, Iran has strongly condemned the recent US airstrikes on Iraq and Syria, dismissing the accusations Washington leveled against Tehran to justify the attacks. In a letter to the President of the United Nations Security Council, Iran's ambassador rejected the accusation that the US launched the airstrikes to prevent attacks by Iran or Iran-backed groups on U.S. interests. Majid Taftarabanchi said such allegations are completely baseless as Iran has never been directly or indirectly involved in any armed attack on American personnel and facilities in Iraq. The ambassador also rejected the arbitrary interpretation of the UN Charter by the U.S. to justify its illegal airstrikes on Iraq and Syria. He slammed Washington for breaching the sovereignty of the two Arab nations, saying the U.S. will fail in its attempt to cover up its destabilizing moves. Political analyst Tony Gosling believes that Washington is after intimidating forces fighting U.S.-sponsored Takfiri terrorists by airstrikes on Iraq and Syria.
ISIL is a U.S.-sponsored, NATO-sponsored force, as was al-Qaeda. These are just another prong in the tripod, if you want, that the devil is pointing towards the Middle East from the United States, from Britain, from Israel, which is to destabilize the region. They want to balkanize that region. They want to redraw boundaries because their attitude is that unless you do as we say, as they've done, you know, I think over most of they've attempted to do anyway, over most of the Eurasian continent, if you don't do as we say, we're going to just cause trouble for you. And this is all really just intimidation tactics, nothing to do whatsoever with international law. I cannot see how they could possibly manage to persuade anybody in the Western press that this is in order to block Iranian influence somehow, because it doesn't seem to be any real direct link between Iran and the people that the Americans are trying to attack in Syria and Iraq. To me, I mean, as a Western journalist, am particularly disgusted by the way that the Americans, can continually get away with these sorts of accusations, even at the UN Security Council, saying that this is somehow within the constraints of the UN Charter, because they're trying to defend themselves. Seems absurd to me.
Nearly 300 Palestinians are injured after Israeli forces attack anti-settlement protesters near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The Palestinian Red Crescent said Israeli forces used live rounds and rubber-coated bullets, as well as tear gas against the protesters. It said four Palestinians suffered injuries to the head. The violence broke out when Palestinian protesters gathered in the town of Beita to demand the removal of the Aviata settlement outpost. Israeli forces had killed several Palestinians and injured dozens more during anti-settlement protests over the past weeks. Israeli authorities have decided to remove the settlement to turn it into a military base, pending a new decision. The residents of Beita, however, reject the move, vowing to continue their protests. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip mark the 15th anniversary of the Israeli siege on their territory. The crippling siege has affected all aspects of life in the enclave, worsening the economy and depriving some 2 million people of freedom. Ruba Shabit has more from Gaza.
Over 1 month since a ceasefire came into force between the Israeli regime and Hamas, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip still suffer from psychological trauma and feel unsafe. While fears are rising of another round of violence, Palestinians mark 15 years of a land, air, and sea Israeli blockade that has devastated Gaza's economy and caused widespread destruction leaving most people largely cut off from the outside world.
The Israeli blockade imposed for 15 years led Palestinians to call for simple solutions. This blockade, of course, affected all life aspects, especially the rate of poverty and unemployment. There are many graduates who are jobless now. Wars and Israeli blockade isolated Gaza from the world, and it's not surprising that many countries know nothing about Gaza.
Israeli blockades imposed on the Gaza Strip affected badly on all life aspects, leading to high rates of poverty and unemployment. Most of the working-age population in the Gaza Strip are unemployed and without any source of income due to the lack of job opportunities.
There are a lot of graduated people without a job in Gaza. The unemployment rate is high and there are no job opportunities. For 15 years, we have been living in the same situation. There has been continuous escalations and war over Gaza, and people will suffer from everything and nothing changes.
Due to the limited sources and restrictions imposed on movement and entry of goods and fuel, only a limited amount of fuel and cooking gas reach homes and the electricity plant. As a result, Gazans are suffering an electricity crisis that has devastated daily life, especially on clean water, as people in Gaza suffer from salty and polluted water that is not fit for drinking. Both the continuous violence over the Strip and the Israeli blockade affected badly on every aspect of life for Palestinians, isolating and depriving them from their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Now, the Russian military says terrorists are planning a false flag chemical attack in Syria's Idlib province. The Russian Center for Reconciliation of the Opposing Parties in Syria said the terrorists have delivered 10 barrels of toxic substances to an area near the village of Harim. It said terrorists and White Helmets, a group operating under the guise of aid work in Syria, have been involved in the delivery. According to the report, the terrorists are planning to blame the Syrian government for the attack. Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since 2011. Damascus says Israel and its Western and regional allies are aiding the Takfiri terrorist groups that are wreaking havoc in the country. Now, the White House says the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan is expected to complete before a September 11 deadline.
On Afghanistan, the president said earlier he does not think the drawdown will be done in a few days. The Pentagon has said it's ahead of schedule, the September 11th date. So what is the latest date that the White House is looking at right now?
Well, we currently expect it to be completed by the end of August. So as you know, the president decided to withdraw remaining U.S. troops from Afghanistan and finally end the U.S. war there after 20 years.
The White House spokeswoman said President Joe Biden has long felt the war in Afghanistan cannot be won militarily. She added that some Afghan translators cooperating with the U.S. military will be relocated to outside the country. The Pentagon has confirmed the transfer of the Bagram base to Afghan forces, but it says the U.S. military retains what it calls the authority to protect Afghan forces.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the U.S. military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what U.S. President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all U.S. forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The US and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the US invasion failed to uproot the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the US military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to US media reports, more than 2,400 US military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The US war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which although failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
Well, political commentator Brian Downing says the United States has failed in its objectives in Afghanistan.
Well, I think it's been pretty clear for several years now that the United States could not win the war, could not defeat the Taliban, and probably was unable to even limit the Taliban to the south and the east. It is spreading in the north, which is an area that is not heavily Pashtun at all. There is a Pashtun pocket. But, you know, this just goes back to 2001. Afghanistan is a landlocked country that was surrounded by countries that were not especially friendly towards the United States. So the idea of a very big effort there was really rather foolhardy.
Top UN officials warned the Security Council of worsening famine and a risk of more clashes in Ethiopia's volatile Tigray region.
One of the most distressing trends is an alarming rise in food insecurity and hunger due to conflict. More than 400,000 people are estimated to have crossed the threshold into famine, and another 1.8 million people are on the brink of famine.
Raja Singham told the council that the humanitarian situation in Tigray has worsened dramatically in recent weeks. He said the number of people suffering famine has now risen by nearly 50,000. According to Raja Singham, 33,000 children are severely malnourished. Tigray has witnessed fighting between Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's forces and regional leaders since late 2020. The fighting has killed thousands of people and displaced many more. Political commentator Abiyomi Ezekiwe says humanitarian assistance has become more difficult in Ethiopia's Tigray.
The Ethiopian National Defense Forces and the central government personnel withdrew from Mekelle, which is the provincial capital of Tigray. And this was after the government took control of the province last November, citing a threat from officials of the former government, which now control the province of Tigray, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Today, there were reports in the New York Times that Ethiopian National Defense Forces troops were marched through the capital of Mekelle. These troops who were captured, apparently, by the TPLF. Also, there were reports that a bridge over the Tetezi River was destroyed, which is going to make humanitarian assistance more difficult for the United Nations and other humanitarian groups which are attempting to get into Tigray. So it's still a very volatile situation that's going on in Ethiopia.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has urged global action to tackle discrimination against people of African descent. In a landmark report, the Council cites concerns in 60 countries, including the US, the UK, Belgium, France, Canada, Brazil, and Colombia. Ahmed Cabello has more with this report from London.
We have a duty to fight for.
Stop denying racism and start dismantling it. Those were the unequivocal comments by Michelle Bachelet, the United Nations Human Rights Chief, following a landmark report launched after the killing of George Floyd in the United States, which called on countries worldwide to do more to tackle the systemic racism against people of African descent.
I'm calling on all states to stop denying and start dismantling racism. to end impunity and build trust, to listen to the voices of people of African descent, and to confront past legacies and deliver redress.
The report found that police use of racial profiling and excessive force was systemic in much of North America, Europe, and Latin America.
We're suffering right across the world. Adam Traoré in France, George Floyd in America, Dalian Atkinson and Kevin Clark here in the United Kingdom. You know, 24 people were shot in the favelas of African descent by Brazilian police, you know, in the last 12 months. So you can see that wherever you look.
It also concluded that racism was the biggest problem in countries steeped in the history of the transatlantic slave trade, which ultimately laid the foundation for much of the wealth they enjoy today.
The report highlighted the UK as one of 60 countries that needs to do more to help bring an end to systemic racism, notably urging them to apologise to people of African descent and make amends through reparations. Yet despite the UK playing a leading role in the transatlantic slave trade, so far the British state has shown an unwillingness to do either.
It's got a severe bout of his historical amnesia, and to make those concessions now would give legal jurisdiction to a claim for reparations that would run into tens of hundreds of millions of pounds. And so the British government, and not just this one, successive British governments right throughout the last 50 years have continually denied the claim of reparations here in the United Kingdom.
Michelle Bachelet acknowledged the pivotal role that the Black Lives Matter movement played in bringing this conversation to the forefront, but accepted that now it's on states around the world to take concrete action and make amends for centuries of violence and discrimination. But for countries like the United Kingdom, just issuing an apology would be a start. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
I'm going to turn to some coronavirus news now. South Africa suffers a record daily rise in infections, logging more than 24,000 cases on Friday. Authorities also reported 303 more deaths, raising the total death toll to over 61,000. This comes as hospitals are overwhelmed with incoming critically ill patients, especially in the main city of Johannesburg. South Africa has vaccinated just over 3 billion of its population of nearly 60 million. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. After 5 years, the biggest casualties of Brexit are in plain sight. Integrity and decency in public life are crumbling, says Will Hutton, writer, in an article published under the heading, Case for Brexit was built on lies. 5 years later, the deceit is routine in UK politics. Stay tuned for more. After 5 years, the biggest casualties of Brexit are in plain sight. Integrity and decency in public life are crumbling. Because so much of the case for Brexit is false, the political modus operandi of the Brexiters, now dominating the UK political culture, has become a refusal to accept responsibility for mistakes, overclaiming, deceit, and sometimes outright lies to justify the unjustifiable. Once the electorate can no longer trust what they're told, democratic debate is denied. People have been robbed of a core right of citizenship. It is a form of coup, but with a cloud of nationalist hyperbole disguising the threat to parliamentary democracy. To hold power or challenge it in a democracy requires continual argument and discussion, the precondition of which is a commitment to truth-telling and assured acceptance of facts, however differently they may be interpreted. Trash those preconditions, and we inevitably slide into a universe of division and distrust impervious to rational argument. The British are all belittled. It is as the Brexit right once. Brexit has given it a cause and a political coalition that leaves it more firmly in control of power than at any time since peak Thatcherism. It is not only partisan right-wing policies, from the impending assault on public service broadcasting to the criminal failure to provide additional teaching to compensate for COVID-induced teaching losses. It is the gerrymandering that favors the Tory interest. Voter suppression, rendering the Electoral Commission even more toothless. Ensuring all trustees and chairs of public bodies are conservative. Weakening judicial review. Abolishing the Fixed-Term Parliaments Act. Eliminating any proportionality in the voting system for mayors. Not accepting the doctrine of ministerial accountability. And all couched in a language of defiant nationalism so that critics can be dismissed as un-British friends of the foreigner and outriders for wokedom. This entire edifice is the consequence of Brexit being indefensible in rational terms, so that even boasts of success rest on presentational legendary main morphing into deceit. Thus, last week, the unpersuasive list offered by Boris Johnson in favor of Brexit. It comprised 8 free ports, permissible within the EU and whose limited success is created by diverting economic activity from elsewhere rather than creating activity. A successful vaccine program, impossible within the EU. Since June 1st, Germany, France, and Italy's 7-day average vaccination rates have exceeded Britain's. Control of borders. Numbers of EU immigrants have fallen while numbers of non-EU immigrants have risen, so that overall immigration is barely changed. Investment in jobs being unlocked. To the extent the government has made any such investment, it would never have been prevented by the EU. Finally, achieving the Australian trade deal, under which Australian exports to Britain will rise 6 times more than British exports to Australia. In truth, the gains are either non-existent or paltry. The losses, on the other hand, are massive, real, and not addressed by ministers. British trade with the EU has fallen by a fifth in the first 3 months of 2021, a drop normally associated with an economic slump. The international barons of private equity circle the stricken firms in an orgy of asset stripping. British have fallen from first to fifth in the ranking of states winning EU scientific research funding. Culminatively, exports of services are now more than £100 billion below what pre-Brexit trends suggested. Farmers are losing 25% of their basic EU grant this year and tremble for their viability. The prospects of Irish reunification have never looked so likely. UK relations with the EU are immersed with hostility and distrust. A new concert of powers to govern the world, the US, EU, India, China, Russia, and Japan, is discussed in Washington, a list that conspicuously does not include global Britain. Small wonder that Johnson and the Conservative Party want to see Brexit as a done deal, from which there is no going back. "We have that lemon dry," he told The Atlantic magazine. To acknowledge these weaknesses would delegitimize the whole enterprise. Thus, further deceit compounds the original deceit, sin on sin. No government minister can acknowledge, for example, the astonishing asymmetry of the Australian trade deal and its disproportionate advantage to Australia, or the concessions made on meat standards. Johnson and the Brexit minister, Lord Frost, portray the frictions in trade between Northern Ireland and mainland Britain as a surprise, even though Johnson resigned over Theresa May's backstop designed to avoid them. The dissimulations don't wash. There are some signs that the public is noticing. Today's Observer opinion poll shows 43% now disapprove of the government handling of Brexit, up 4% since January. Only 33% approve, down 3%. Perhaps even more surprising, given the paucity of public argument in favor of the EU, 27% would rejoin against 22% who want more distance, while another 22% favor a stronger relationship. Moreover, suspicions that the government is not as straight with the country are spreading beyond the argument over the EU. Journalist Peter O'Byrne argues in his remarkable short book, The Assault on Truth, that the culture of truth abuse and avoidance of responsibility are part and parcel of the entire approach of Johnson and his government, from the referendum campaign to the management of COVID, aided and abetted by disgracefully compliant media. Yet Brexit is at the heart of this struggle over truth and integrity. The lies that gave birth to it led to Johnson's rise to the prime ministership. It is this recognition propelling the rapid growth in membership of pro-European campaigning groups, such as the European Movement and Grassroots for Europe. Citizens, despairing of a Labour Party that refuses to do battle on the central fact of British politics, are doing what they can to challenge the Brexit lie. They are acting to preserve integrity. After all, big lies, whether communism or imperialism, collapse in the end. But such collapses need citizens to act. Thank you.
food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and for your information, one day, an arrogant person suggested to Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, not to seat the servants at the same table. The Imam replied, "All persons are created by God. Adam is their father, and Eve is their mother. Everyone will be dealt with by God according to his deeds. Why should there be any discrimination in this world?"
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the things that we should really pay attention to when we want to read a book or pick up a particular book that looks at a particular topic, if you should look at the time frame in which that book was written in. The book that we would like to introduce today to our dear listeners has that particular condition on it, because the book and the person who rather gave the lecture by which the book is based on was, you know, a long time ago, and a lot of things have changed since then, both in the country that this person spoke in. Therefore, we see it not only has a particular time specific, it is also place specific. This is one of the most important things that we should understand, that not every book is general, and every book can be applied everywhere else. This book is for a particular time, for a particular group of people. Yes, it does not mean that general principles cannot be extracted from it, but it requires more effort and more assistance to see that can these particular principles be applied to other places. And also the author, the views of the author, the academic background of the author, and so on and so forth, need to also be understood in his worldview. What is he trying to portray to us? So in the book, rather, which is a lecture that was given by the person or the author, at a particular time, which was then translated into English, will be the subject of our next segment, inshallah. Please stay tuned until then.
They say, oh poor girl, you're so beautiful, you know. So lift the veil from your heart to see the heart of purity. Lift the veil from your heart to see the heart of purity. Lift the veil from your heart and seek the heart of purity.
Welcome back to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Currently, we are discussing the book Our Expectations on the Muslim Woman by Dr. Ali Shariati, and the book has been translated by Lale Bakhtiar, who recently passed away. So this particular book, or rather, it's a booklet. It's a lecture that the author, Dr. Shariati, it doesn't say exactly where he gave it, but it is a lecture which was therefore then translated into English, and it was printed into three parts. And the text discusses women's rights, the personality, and so on and so forth. And it tries to therefore give practical lessons and practical advice on this issue of women's rights. Women's, for example, social relationships, children's rights, family rights, and so on and so forth. Like I said, this book is time specific. A lot of these things that the author has mentioned has already been discussed and has changed. Because if you have to look at where we are today in the year 2021, this book is nearly 50 to 60 years old, if not more, this lecture that was given by the particular author. Hence, it may not be as relevant as we see to be. So anyway, the author here obviously speaking at that particular time, obviously being at the time before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, maybe during a time of turmoil. It is not said exactly when the speech was given, as I mentioned, nor does it say when it was given. And it speaks about things that, you know, speak about certain traditional and cultural things that had or were occurring in Iran at that particular time. And then how is a person then able to change this and make it more Islamic in terms of Islamic upbringing, Islamic social relationships, and so on and so forth. And as I mentioned again, what is the author's definition of Islam? What does he mean by Islam? And all these type of things need to be acquired from the other books that the author may have. For as we know that Dr. Shariati was a socialist, was a person, what I mean by socialist, a person who was very socially active. A social activist is maybe a better word, but he was not a person who studied Islam in the Hausa or a traditional Hausa system. But this book, inshallah, may be beneficial to certain individuals who want to see as a historical background what the conditions of women were before the Islamic Revolution and after. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a part of this lecture, rather, from Dr. Shariati. Please stay tuned.
The Quran names several chapters in honor of women. Al-Nisa, or the woman, is one chapter. Or as the late Sheikh Ahmad Kuftaro taught, in defense of women. This chapter conveys many subjects regarding women's affairs and rights. Another chapter in the Quran devoted to women is named Al-Mujadila, or the woman with plea. There is yet another chapter in the Quran named Mary, after the Virgin Mary, mother of Jesus. These chapters constitute a giant step in the liberation of women from the earlier beliefs of superstition. Men shall have a share of what their parents and kinsmen leave. Women shall have a share of what their parents and kinsmen leave. Whether it be little or much, it is legally theirs. Quran 4:7.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We have been discussing the book, or rather the lecture that was translated into English by Dr. Ali Shariati, known as Our Expectations on the Muslim Woman, that was translated by Lale Bakhtiar. So in the beginning of the book, in the very first chapters, the doctor speaks and mentions this. Prior to beginning my lecture, I would like to propose some practical suggestions. speaking about women's rights, women's personality, and Islam's view of woman differs a great deal from the realization of the actual value which Islam gives to human beings and to women in particular. Often we are satisfied by pointing out that Islam gives great value to science or establishes progressive rights for women. Unfortunately, we never actually use or benefit from these values or rights. We could benefit from these if we were to act according to the understanding which we acquire from them. Many people are acquainted with Islamic views of society, social relations, women's rights, children's rights, and family rights. But these same people tend to follow non-Islamic, ancient cultural traditions and do not dare to base their lives upon Islamic values. That is, they do not practice what they preach. Thus, we always remain at the level of talking. We must complete Islamic views and intellectual discussions with practical solutions. We must find a way whereby we reach these values and rights in practice. After proposing my views, the question should be asked, how can we actually put them into practice? Throughout history, the problem of women's rights and their role has always been considered to be an intellectual problem. Hence, various religious, philosophical, and social systems have reached varying views in this respect. Inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters, until our next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Science fiction has turned into reality, or at least that's how the developer of Aircar describes his vehicle when it transforms from a car into an aircraft in less than 3 minutes. This prototype flying car was designed and created by Slovakian transportation professor Stefan Klein. He says that his design opens a new category in transportation. The dual-mode vehicle composed a 35-minute flight in this week between the two Slovakian airports. So far, it has completed more than 40 hours of test flight. Aircar can fly about 1,000 kilometers at a height of over 2,500 meters. That makes the dream of those who wish to ride above traffic closer to reality. A digital art museum in the Japanese capital has unveiled a stunning exhibition offering visitors an intimate interaction with nature. One of the attractions of the show is Floating Flower Garden, which is a mirrored room filled with 13,000 orchid flowers. The orchids are dangling from the ceiling and move up once a visitor walks through in the space and approaches the flowers. Once the visitors move past, the flowers descend again. This makes the visitors able to freely wander around the three-dimensional flower mass space. Tokyo-based digital art group Team Lab that runs this exhibition says The artwork is designed to help people think that they are part of the garden.
This is an installation filled with these flowers. As you walk towards them, the flowers slowly move up to create an area of space for you. Surrounded so completely by flowers, you feel immersed in the flowers, the garden itself.
There are several other installations in this exhibition. One is an outdoor piece filled with oil sculptures that light up after the sun sets. Visitors can see 61 different colors of light in this section. When one of the Ovids tipped over by a hand or the wind, it emits a sound. The sound is then echoed by the surrounding Ovids. In a school in the Ukrainian capital, kids learn about saving the environment and helping those in need through a creative way. Students put plastic bottles in a machine as currency. Then they can select what they would like to spend money on. Buying food for stray animals and donating to children with special needs are some of the choices. The project was first launched in a mall in Kiev a few months ago. Afterwards, the designers found out that children were the most frequent users of this machine.
A child drops a bottle inside and sees an immediate result. It brings joy and happiness, and everyone is excited and wants the project to thrive.
The founders seek to install more and more machines in schools across Ukraine to raise environmental awareness among younger generations. Since the start of the project in October last year, over 5 tons of plastic has been collected from 6 machines.
India is known not only for its cultural diversity, but also for a vibrant assortment of uncountable dishes. Butter chicken is the only one delight you wouldn't like to miss while visiting Indian restaurants, especially if it is prepared by a celebrity chef like Saransh Goyla. Goyla's coal-fired oven is now sending a mouth-watering scent through India's commercial hub Mumbai as the young chef takes a break from COVID-19 relief efforts and resumes work. He is the one who established the first global butter chicken brand and authored the acclaimed food travelogue India on My Platter. But with the coronavirus forcing people into isolation, his networks were also hit. So Goyla launched a non-profit platform called COVID Meals for India in April to connect thousands of volunteer home cooks and frontline workers.
The pandemic had a large impact on our business. Having said that, Goyla Butter Chicken from the start was always focused on deliveries and takeaway. So in that sense, our loss of revenue and a loss of business was slightly lesser than an average restaurant. But a lot of my friends, restaurateurs who are in this industry have gone through an extremely tough time. The pandemic has taken its toll on our industry, and I think it has set us back by at least a couple of years.
Goyla found his calling early, winning a televised cooking competition at the age of 25, which led him to host a travel program showcasing regional Indian cuisine. His profile exploded in 2018 when he was invited by former MasterChef Australia judge George Kalambaris to be a guest on the hit show, with contestants asked to recreate his signature dish.
Graduation is an exciting moment for all schoolgoers, but the occasion turns more joyful if it ends with a celebration like Scarlet Sales Festival, which is held in St. Petersburg in Russia at the end of the school year. The annual event is part of the famous White Nights Festival, traditionally held in summer with spectacular fireworks, numerous music concerts, and a massive water show. Normally, thousands of domestic and foreign tourists flock to the city to watch the colorful event. But this year, the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of the attendees. The festival began in the 1960s when several Russian schools united to celebrate the end of the academic year. that is in connection with the symbolism of the popular 1922 children's book, Scarlet Sails, by Alexander Grimm. Indonesia is dealing with a surge in coronavirus infections, but that has not stopped the people from observing the Yatnya Kasada Festival. Thousands of people braved the climb to the summit of Mount Bromo in eastern Java province to observe the ancient ritual. They made offerings ranging from fruits and crops to livestock by throwing the items to the pit of an active volcano. They believe the practice brings blessings and plenitude and helps them express gratitude for what they have. This year's festival was overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, with participants required to adhere to strict health protocols. China's space agency has released videos of its first Mars rover as it's exploring the red planet's surface. The rover is named Zhurong. It's now investigating a vast plane known as Utopia Planitia on Mars's northern hemisphere. The rover successfully landed on Mars in mid-May. It is studying the red planet's surface rocks and atmosphere. It also looks for signs of life, including any subsurface water or ice. The solar-powered Chinese robot weighs around 240 kilograms and has 6 wheels. China is the second country after the U.S. to operate a rover on Mars. A university in the Venezuelan capital Caracas has turned its roof into a garden and uses sustainable energy to light up its classes. The roof of Andres Bello Catholic University is covered with plants and 30 solar panels. The panels, along with a wind turbine, produce the 7,400 watts of electricity to illuminate that area and light 2 rooms in the building. The roof is now functioning as a self-sufficient and environmentally friendly open-air classroom. The proposal for the project was put forward by 2 students. The aim is to educate people about renewable energy and the threat of climate change.
A small New Hampshire town has been hit by a series of car break-ins over the last few weeks. People were shocked when they finally discovered the mischievous criminal. A large black bear has been identified as the bandit, wreaking havoc in the town of Thornton. The naughty mammal was caught on camera as it got on its 2 hind legs and skillfully opened the door of a car. Police say the bear was most likely rummaging for food. Authorities have asked people to remove food from their cars to avoid enticing the troublesome animal. A Jordanian woman is receiving high demands for the soap she produces. Why? Because she uses an unusual ingredient. Lara Altiti makes soap out of camel milk. She tours different cities in Jordan to find the best camel farms for her business. Titi uses camel milk as the major ingredient for the soap she produces. That's because she says it has rich benefits and contains more vitamins than cow milks.
The first stage includes weighing the soap, and I include different kinds of oil to preserve the quality of the soap and its therapeutic benefit. We need to have high foam and tough consistency, and we don't want it to be rancid. We place high importance on the therapeutic material that we add during the production process.
Titi started her soap line at home using a manual process and then expanded it to an independent workshop. Her soap line has now become very popular in Jordan. Titi produces more than 4,000 soap bars a month. She tells them, sells them both to domestic and international customers.
If you're a car lover, this this story is for you. Over 300 classic vehicles have taken part in a retro rally across Estonia. The 1,000-kilometer rally kicked off in the town of Perde. It drew participants from Latvia and Finland. Their motto is Straight Ahead to the Past. The vintage cars participated in the event are mostly produced between 1930 and 1980. Experts say all the vehicles are in good condition. However, they doubt if all the vehicles can make it to the end of the five-day rally.
German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot, just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out, and we want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter. It will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games. Walking around the city without shoes can be delightful. If you're interested in the experience, visit the Russian capital. A 3.5-kilometer long barefoot trail has recently opened in Moscow's Elk Island Park. It's made of various materials such as pine bark, beach pebbles, and clay. Taking around 40 minutes to complete, the path attracts hundreds of visitors every day. However, some people find it difficult to walk without shoes, calling the path a torture trail. A zoo in Turkey has welcomed a baby elephant from an endangered species. The birth of a female calf at Izmir Wildlife Park has caused excitement in keepers and visitors. The calf, yet to be named, is the third offspring of parents from Asian species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies the Asian elephant as endangered due to their rapid decline in the wild. The Asian elephants are primarily threatened by poaching, fragmentation, and loss and degradation of habitat. Currently, around 20 to 40,000 Asian elephants are living across the world, five of which inhabiting Turkey's Izmir Zoo.
A Palestinian artist has come up with the idea of making children feel happy after the recent Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip left many people dead. Amna Sami is a young Palestinian artist who has gathered Palestinian kids in the city of Beit Lahia, north of Gaza. That's where houses were destroyed by Israeli airstrikes and bombings during the recent aggression on the territory. Sami draws the Palestinian flag as well as the map of Palestine on children's cheeks as patriotic symbols. She says she does that to say that these people in the midst of destruction will become strong again. Sami says by painting on kids' faces, she wants to send a message to the world.
I'm sending